We're going to finish out this hour with two very different looks at the popular messaging of science. Hollywood and sci-fi geeks are in love with sexy black holes and galaxy clusters, stellar nebulae and supernovas, you know that. Much less so with boring neutrinos, ions, and asteroids, even though they might have more to do with our day-to-day lives here on Earth, especially a colliding asteroid. Oh, yeah. In a moment, physicist Brian Cox on the importance of understanding the real principles of physics in our day-to-day lives. But first, from a biological perspective, we may intellectually understand that biodiversity on our planet is a good thing, but that doesn't make us any more affectionate towards, say, the longhorn beetle. Nice beetle. I don't suppose you named it or anything. Anybody want to adopt this golden-rumped elephant shrew? I guess it looks a little bit like an elephant. Ew. But start talking about adorable panda bears going extinct, and suddenly there's not a dry eye in the house.
Let's call her Squeaky.
You know, if we pick the species to save based on this survival of the cuteness principle, the planet could become a lost world of fluffy, adorable, cuddly, useless species surrounded by starving humans and I guess a lot of ants and flies with no fear of predators because they all went extinct. Joining us now, Christine Delamore is a news editor for NationalGeographic.com. She joined us today from Washington, D.C. Christine, welcome.
Hi.
So tell me about this special last of the last series that you're doing at National Geographic, which really explores our psychological connection to what endangered species we fall in love with and what ones we have a difficult time connecting with, but maybe more important.
Sure. Well, we noticed on our website that unusual rare species were really resonating with our audience because they were giving people an opportunity to learn about an animal they might not have ever heard before, you know, beyond the panda or the tiger. So we wanted to take a closer look at some of these species that are disappearing without our, you know, without the wider world knowing about them, and also take a deeper dive into how we're prioritizing what to save and what are some creative methods for bringing these species back.
Do humans have a decent track record when they get mobilized of saving species, or is it just very symbolic kind of zoo business?
They actually do. A good example is the California condor in the 90s that had declined to about 22 animals, and there was a concerted effort to breed the bird in captivity and then release it back into the wild. And it's amazing that it's recovered to about 200 animals, and a conservationist told me a few weeks ago he saw one flying through the Grand Canyon. So there you have a success story. The gray wolf, for example, has rebounded in the West. The northern elephant seal has also come back. So conservation can work, and it's proven to work in many cases.
You know, your project reminds me of the snail darter controversy. Do you remember that?
The fish, right?
Yeah. It was a species of weird creature that actually blocked the building of a dam and became a big political firestorm back in the 80s when conservatives said that the environmental movement had overreached, and it was very, very difficult to have anybody fall in love with the snail darter.
Right.
And, how many of these kinds of political battles can we expect to see?
Right. Well, there are a lot of funders and a lot of governments like to rally around the well-known species, for example, the panda bears, and that helps get funding for the animal. But there's another strategy that's emerging that a lot of nonprofit groups are embracing, which is if you save the tiger's entire range, you might also protect a lot of the animals that live in the range, for example, the pygmy hog that nobody knows about. So it kind of is indirectly benefiting under this umbrella of protection. So conservationists are recognizing that people like these well-known fuzzy species, but they're also trying to devise ways to save the lesser-known ones at the same time.
So take a bigger view than just species and
exactly.
Try to look at ecosystems where you have interrelated
yes.
people who will pull each other up.
Yes.
Now, what about creating a set of priorities that assigns a value to a species based on its importance in the ecosystem as opposed mm-hmm. to simply what it looks like?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an algorithm that's kind of gaining popularity that looks at it from a mathematical perspective. I'm not aware of one that looks at the ecosystem value, although there are conservationists who argue, you know, we should save ants as opposed to pandas because ants are so valuable to the environment. The mathematical model is interesting. Australia just this week decided that its national conservation strategy would be looking at how to save species through a cost-effective method. So how do they get the most bang for their buck? New Zealand adopted it, I believe, last year. So, you know, that model seems to be rising to the forefront.
Does something like the Project Prioritization Protocol
exactly
get us away from these cuteness things that, you know, float the panda to the top?
I think so. You know, it definitely depends on what situation you're in and, you know, the players that you're working with. But the key is to try to, you know, rally as many people as you can around the idea that species are important and that, you know, there are often moral and economic and ethical reasons to save them. Like, there's not just one reason.
Finally, I mean, you can raise money around the pandas and use the money for something besides pandas. I mean, the pandas aren't going to know the difference.
That's true. Yeah, that was something that a lot of conservationists mentioned, too. For example, you know, trying to change people's perceptions of shark fin soup in Asia. You might dedicate some of your funding not only to conserve sharks, but also to educate people that putting shark fins in your soup is not the best idea. So conservation funds can be used for a lot of different strategies and methods to try to change people's values in that way.
Christine Delamore is news editor for NationalGeographic.com. They're doing a series on endangered species and how we view them as conservationists. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we asked you guys to choose between three endangered species, the giant panda, the gray-faced elephant shrew, and the American burying beetle. What would you save? 58% said the panda. Come on, you guys are so predictable. No surprises there. 38% picked the shrew. We'd like to invite you all to a shrew party here in New York City. And only 4% would save the beetle. See, these are my people. Poor little beetle. You can take our poll online at thetakeaway.org. Earlier this hour, we asked, who do you trust? And we got this great answer from St. Peter's, Missouri. Science. And I don't mean scientists. I just mean science. Coming up, another look at science and messaging, a new documentary series trying to instill a trust in science in the public. British physicist Ryan Cox is up next. Stay with us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.